I've identified, and there's some strange things about the book. There's some one or two things that really strike me about the book. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that it's all about the tabernacle. If that means anything to you, that's the place that Moses built in the wilderness for worship. And it's odd that it was written at a time when the temple was standing in Jerusalem. So he keeps going on, hearkening back to a period really hundreds and hundreds of years before the time when he's writing, and almost as if some of the things that were there in their own time, it's as if they're not there. He's almost like passes over them. Always found that quite mysterious. And the other thing that I find kind of mysterious about this book is that when you get to this, which is one of my, one of the most encouraging three verses in the book. I mean, it's a wonderful book. But when it gets to this, it's just so encouraging that something very, very odd happens. It's like he's been writing about something. His mind has been fixed on something. He's been plowing a furrow for 11 chapters. He's in full preaching mode. He's been holding on to his theme and being persistent and consistent about it. And then suddenly he picks up a theme that there's no precedent to in the whole of the book beforehand. It seems to pop out of nowhere. It comes from the left field. And it leaves me saying, why are we now talking about this? But I think it's really, really important. And I've been given some time and some thought to trying to pray it through. Why, as he writes the book, he makes it, it doesn't last. He stays with it. He brings this new illustration in and then goes back to the way he was talking before. But for a moment, he fixes everybody's eyes on something completely different, something that he hasn't addressed before at all. You see, all the way through the book of Hebrews, if you're familiar with it, the main motif, the main illustration, the main theme that he picks up is the worship that takes place in the tabernacle. He's talking about the priesthood. He's talking about the sacrifices. He's talking about the worship of God. He's talking about the covenant, the old covenant under Moses. And he keeps saying time and time again, the tabernacle was there, but we've got a better temple now. And he says, we've got a priesthood there. We've got a better priesthood now. He's saying, we've got wonderful sacrifices, but we've got a better sacrifice now. And all the way through, there's this theme of the temple, of worship, of the tabernacle. And then suddenly, in chapter 12 and verse 1, it's like we've been teleported and we're in the middle of a running track. I don't know if you find it kind of frustrating sometimes when you're sitting watching television, you're watching a program and you're really into it and you're getting really drawn into your program and then somebody flicks the channel. But it's a little bit like that. Right, I'm watching this really interesting program about the tabernacle. You know, I've gone back 2,000 years. I'm doing this, watching an interesting program about the tabernacle and all the detail and the priesthood and the sacrifices and the covenants. And then suddenly it's the Olympics. It's like, hang on a minute, what happened there? Somebody's flicked the channel. Well, I think there's a real reason. He's coming to the end of his book. He's coming to the end of his letter. He's coming to the end of his message. And what he's getting down to, he's been talking about the olden days, the way things used to be, and likening those good old days in a way, and sort of saying they were good, but there is something even better now. That's the big point that he's making. They were glorious. God's first beginnings with us were glorious. But in these present days, he is doing something more glorious. That's the great point that he's trying to make. He's bringing them up to speed. He's bringing them up into the present day. He's getting to them to make their religion function and practice now. It has a great and glorious past. We have a great heritage and a great legacy that we've inherited. But what are we doing with it now? How are you living your life now? Even in the book of Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, it begins with, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. Now. Living our lives, our Christian lives, now. And he's used all his illustrations and his discussions about the former times and almost like the glory glow of things before as a basis of conversation to get them to think about what is God doing in your life today? What's happening now in your lives? And in fact, if you go back to the beginning of the book of Hebrews in chapter 1 and verses 1 through to 2, which really open up the theme, he says, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors. He's talking about the past. He even uses the word ancestors. He's casting their minds right back through the prophets. many times and in various ways. But then he says, but in these last days, that's now, in there now, he is speaking to us by his Son. He wants them to live in the here and now. Because the tabernacle was glorious, but God is doing a new thing. You know, all the time, games and stuff like that on people's computers or their software programs, you get this little thing that pops up and says, a new update. Install the new update, you know? And if you don't, you find that all the functionality of your computer starts to break down, doesn't it? Nothing's compatible anymore, and you try to load new software, and it doesn't work. You've got to be in the current operating system. And he wants them to be absolutely up to speed and in the present with God, not living in the past and dealing with him with him in the way that he was dealt with, but dealing with him as he would be dealt with today, here and now. We do sometimes get accused. I think one person put it, poor chattering Christianity. I think that was a little expression that one of our critics used. We spend a lot of time sitting in rooms on comfy chairs, reading books, praying, closing our eyes, singing songs and all this sort of thing. But in practical terms, it's almost as if we're some sort of an irrelevance. We withdraw into our little ghettos, our little communities. We do our thing. We create our Christian societies, our Christian radio stations, our Christian television stations, our Christian grocery shop, our Christian magazines and books and all the rest of it. And before you know it, we have become an ivory tower, completely and utterly detached from the world. The real world. I mean, it's all real. We're all everything. If you're life and breath, it's real. Don't get me wrong. But there's mud and blood out there. That's the point. That is the point. And Christianity and Christ will not allow us to retreat forever into the sanctuary and abide there, hanging on to the horns of the altar. There was one commissioning speech given by somebody appointing a minister. And in his commissioning speech, he said, do not keep your people feasting, but send them out to war. You know, that you could almost like create so many programs and stuff and bring people in and do all this stuff, and it all becomes about church, and the only people you know are Christians, and you're feasting on the word, and it's this conference and that, and I'm not being disparaging about edifying ourselves and all these things, but in the end, we've got to get out there. Agreed? You've got to get out there. Because these are the things that we can only do while we're here, the things that need doing while we're here. We have to live publicly for Christ. People need an opportunity to see what a Christian looks like, how a Christian conducts themselves, how they behave, the things they say. When you bash your thumb with a hammer, let there be witnesses. Let there be witnesses to see how a Christian suffers. John Wesley famously said, my people die well. My people die well. Face the facts that when we open our Bibles, we are reading things that were written a very long time ago. Everything was written a long time ago. The events that are recorded there took place a long time ago. And we could become academics. We could just spend our time trawling over the past and becoming experts in, you know, early Palestinian Judaism or whatever, or sort of neo-Babylonian archaeology and all the rest of it, fascinating though it is. But if in the end all those academic pursuits and interests don't finally realize and crystallize and get contextualized into the way you live your life today in the here and now, it's vanity. We are the vessels, the means by which God takes these things and work in and through us to produce a living, vibrant, real religion practicable in everyday life, on the work face of everyday life. And that, I think, is the reason why the writer of Hebrews finally has to jolt them into the reality of their present-day situation and dispel the lovely kind of reflective moment, thinking about things ancient and past and glorious, and bring them back to the football stadium, bring them back to the cricket ground, bring them back to the speedway, whatever it is, the roar of human competition and all the rest of it. It's fierce out there, isn't it? It's fierce. And we're not to be afraid. We're not to be afraid. As Christians, we can go from the temple. And in one sense, this is what we do, isn't it? We come to the temple. We come to the tabernacle. We come to dwell with God. We come to feed on God. We come to look at Him and consider Him. And we get fed and we get filled. And then we go. Then we go from the tabernacle to the stadium, to the track, to the running track, and take our place on the blocks and run another lap, and off we go, and off we go. The Roman amphitheatres, I'm not going to go into this for a long time. Having said everything I've just said, I've got to be a bit careful not to dwell on it for too long. But basically, the Roman amphitheatres, you know, they had these big banks of seats all around, and essentially there was this long hippodrome track, and there would be at one place would be where the honoured dignitary would sit, and the beginning of any race, whether it was a chariot race or anything else, would be right opposite. Usually the Caesar or the king would be sitting there presiding over the beginning of the race, and they'd drop their hanky or whatever it was, and the race would begin. They'd have the honour of commencing the race. And then you'd run, or you'd go on your horses, or whatever it is you do, and you'd go around, and for a while you've actually got your back to the person who's begun the race. And so you're running, and then you get up to the curve, and I suppose you get to a point, you come back, and as you turn the corner, for the first time as you turn the corner, that person comes into view once again. And as you turn the corner, you actually look up and you can see them there. You can see them there, the one who started the race, the one who's going to award the prizes. And hopefully what happens is that your heart just, in a fresh burst of adrenaline, discharges into all your arteries, and bang, off you go down the next bit of the line, and down you go down the line. And every now and then, as you're running, because you've got to keep your eye on the track, you just look up, and you just look up, and you look up, and you see, is the king pleased? Am I impressing the master? How am I running? And you run and you run, because you know if you're the first to cross the line, you'll be the first to see him. You'll be the first to see the colour of his eyes. You'll be the one who sees him eye to eye. And he'll applaud you and you'll salute him, and all the glory and honour as you cross the line. And that's the image that is being portrayed here. And those places were loud places where all sorts of things going on, a lot of turmoil, a lot of competition, a lot of extra exertion and stress. I don't know, some of you I know are runners. I run 100 yards from time to time. That's about it, really, in all honesty. Used to be different. But when you're running, you hit various pain barriers, don't you? You run up against various psychological, physical challenges that just scream out. Your body starts to scream out, doesn't it? Your capacity to inject oxygen into your muscles and all the rest of it, and push through the next part, and your legs begin to go, and you have to kind of find the next bit of strength to keep going. And then when you see him, that inspires your heart, doesn't it? You can see the end. You can see the purpose for why you're running. You can set your eyes on the prize. That's the sort of thing that has been talking about here, about setting your eyes on Jesus and running your race and going from the temple, which is that moment when you're standing there looking up at this point where Jesus is sitting there as the beginning of your race, of your Christian life. And then you set off with the view that the day is coming when you're going to come full circuit. You may get glances of him on the way, but the day is coming when you're going to come back to that place and you're going to see him face to face, and you're going to receive from him your reward. As the book of Hebrews goes, in the 11th chapter there, just before, there's this shift. He's been talking about the past. He's been talking about them. He's been talking in chapter 11, verse 39, all these people, the witnesses, all the prophets, the people have gone before us. They've run their race. And then in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, he swaps and he's talking about us. He's talking about here. He's talking about now. He's talking about you. He's talking about me. He's talking about our lives, our Christian lives, our race out there in the world, making what we receive from Christ at the beginning of our Christian life, putting it into practice. And the value there is as you run of glancing up at him and gaining strength and spirit when you see him. Because this is how Jesus lived. This is what Jesus did. Jesus is the champion of this. Jesus is the exemplification of this belief that you take what you receive in the holy place and you go and spend it liberally out there in the world. That's what he did. He came from the most hallowed courts of heaven, in the most pristine gardens of paradise. And he came down into this grimy arena of our world to face the toughest challenge of them all, run the hardest race ever set, and won. He came down, didn't he? And he came to the cross. Now that's a race to run. To run for that, to face that pain, to psychologically just think psychologically, forget physically for a moment, the psychological demands of running towards Calvary. That's where you're headed. That's your destination. That's what you're going for. I am going to the cross. How would your legs carry you? How fast would you run? Jesus ran. Jesus ran, didn't he? He ran and he won. He overcame the toughest of all contests. And now it's our turn. Now it's our turn. He's done it. It's finished. And it's us that are on the track. It's us that are in the race. And we have our opportunity, don't we, to see Jesus. And he is our temple. He is our priest. He is our covenant. He is our sacrifice. He's our all in all. He's our place of worship. Calvary is our refuge. And we consider him there. And then we have to turn our faces like he did and go out into the world and run. Go for it. Go for it. And get out there into the world and live for glory, for his glory, in the stadium of life. And we run and we run and we run, and at the beginning we have that close vision of Jesus, and then we run, and there are times when you can't see him. Do you ever have those experiences? I hope you do. I'll tell you why I hope you do. Because that shows how preoccupied you are with the business that he's given you to do. We cannot spend our whole lives with Jesus at the forefront of our minds. It is impractical. You have to think about other things. You have to fix the car. All right? You have to make a cup of tea. You have to go around and see Auntie Mabel. You have to do everything you have to do. You have to do them and do them with all of your heart, because you can't spend all of your time just considering Jesus. But there are times when you are flagging, when you are growing weary, where you must look round. You must, you know, when you see a runner running and they just see them quickly glancing round and they glance up, you must consider him, because if you don't, you will grow weary and you will fail. You've got to keep considering him in the midst of the race. There are times when it's, as it were, he's behind you. But you just keep running and just know that he's there. Do you always see Jesus? Do you always feel the lift? But I tell you, you know he's there, don't you? Sometimes you've just got to say, I know he's there. I know he sees me, even if I don't see him. Even if I don't feel it, he's there. He's watching me. He's gone before me, and I will see him again. And you run. Ah, what a race. What a race Jesus ran. What a race Jesus ran. I'm always astonished by the way musicians and athletes and so on, some of the faces they pull. You ever get that? You ever notice that? Some of the faces, they pull these contorted faces when they're sort of playing the violin, little this sort of thing. They're totally lost all self-consciousness. They're so determined to excel in what they're doing. They don't care what you think of them. They don't care. They just want to do this thing that they've been given to do with all of their might and all of their strength. And people, if I pulled a face like that, they'd say, what's the matter with you? Something a bit strange about you. But they push past the shame. They push past because what they're doing is so important. It's more important than what people think. And Jesus despised the shame. And if we think a little bit of teasing and ridicule offends us sometimes, doesn't it? Some people are more brittle than others, can take more of it than others. Jesus was crucified. It is the most humiliating death of them all. He didn't care. He didn't care. Because he was fixed, wasn't he, on the prize. Fixed on the prize. And the shame and the pain. I'm talking about dancers whose bones begin to impact on one another, you know, because they're in their feet, ballet dancers whose bones, pianists whose fingers, the arthritis in their fingers, rugby players whose bones and joints and necks and have been broken, however many times their noses have been broken. The pain and the shame, at a certain point when you've got your eye on the prize and something matters to you that much, you don't care anymore. You push past those things because there's a prize. There's a prize. And Jesus pushes past the pain and the shame, and everybody's watching and everybody can see. But there's just one whose opinion counts for him. There's only one. It's the one who will award him the prize. And Jesus receives that prize, doesn't he? He runs his full circle. He comes down from heaven. He comes into the filthy contest. And he emerges as victor. Jesus emerges as victor. Now he's run his full circle and he's come all the way back. And he's back where he started, on his throne. And now it's our turn. Now it's our turn to run. The prophets did it. It's our turn. Are you running? Are you running? I love being in the temple. I love being in the presence of God. I love being in prayer. I love being in worship. I love being in the Bible. I love these things because there's no pain and there's no shame there, if you understand me. There is, perhaps we could unpack that one a little bit more, but in heaven there is nothing but peace and pleasure and joy. The pain, the suffering, the difficulties, the struggles are out there on the track, aren't they, in everyday life, because that, to be put no finer point on it, is where sin is active and at work. And sin is active and at work in us. Would that that were not the case, but it works in our members. And it's working in other people as well, isn't it? Oh, yes. Yes, it is. Sin. And it creates an almighty collision, doesn't it? You get resistance. You meet resistance as you push around the track. And its origins and the source of that resistance is nothing short of sin. We say it in verse 1. It's there in verse 1. We have to throw off the sin that so easily besets us. It quickly attaches itself to us and drags us down and weighs us down. And then as we see in verse 3, Jesus talking about the opposition of sinful men as well. It's not something that's always in us. We're also meeting it in other people. Sin just, there's this kind of, they do these slow, I've been watching a bit of rugby over the last couple of days, and they do these slow motion things on the BBC, you know, some of these two guys, they kind of collide into each other and they just slow it all down. You know, and it is, isn't it? Sometimes you just feel like you're being hit by a truck. Sin's like a truck that hits you. Stuff that's going on in the world, stuff that's going on in your heart. And it'd be so easy to be worn down. It'd be so easy to get psychologically deflated and discouraged and overcome and overwhelmed by it that you start to slow down and you see the man on the track that starts to slow down and now they're walking. And now they're walking and you think they're going to get off and the minute they're going to just turn around and they're going to walk off the track. Run! And how's that going to happen? Look up. Look there. Look at Jesus. Look at Jesus. And just get those feet moving again and get those knees on the go and pick up that speed once again and push past that pain and despise it and the fact that everybody's saying, look at that loser. Just fade it all out and run for Christ Jesus. Run for your prize. We've got people who are shouting out from the stands for us. Yeah, this great cloud of witnesses. I don't know how you read that, the great cloud of witnesses. I'll deal with that relatively briefly. But the great cloud of witnesses, people postulate all sorts of things. But it's obviously these Old Testament saints that you were reading the latter part of chapter 11 there. It's the people who've gone before us. And they don't just sit in the seats with their arms folded and go, let's see if they trip up. That's not the spirit. That's not the spirit. They shout out their testimony of God's glory and dealings in their lives, don't they? They testify through the scripture what God did for Gideon, what God did for Enoch, what God did for Abel, what God did for Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses. And these testimonies shout out from the pages. And they remind us, run! Run! God is God. It's worth it. Keep going. Keep going. Don't give up. When Jesus ran that race, he took on the same race as they all ran, and he overtook them all, didn't he? He beat their lap time. I've got a wonderful illustration which I haven't got time for. Maybe I'll share it with you another time about this guy who won this race. It's absolutely amazing. Absolutely flattened everybody's record. Amazing. Anyway, people say, well, it's okay for Jesus because Jesus didn't have any indwelling sin. I've got indwelling sin, and that makes my capacity to run the race so much harder. Jesus didn't have sin, so it was so much easier. But you read in verse 3, it says, such opposition from sinful men. He may not have had any indwelling sin, but let me tell you, sin assaulted Christ Jesus in ways that you and I, in all honesty, really don't know anything about. The temptation, Satan came personally. Nobody in this room has had a personal visitation from Satan tempting them. But the devil came to Jesus to tempt. The temptations, murder, plots. Is anybody here? Is anybody plotting to crucify you? Such opposition from sinful men. Sin came out to smash Jesus into 1,000 pieces, just like sin would smash us, because the devil hates us, every single one, and would destroy us at an instant given half an opportunity. And he will, if he can. Look at Jesus, keep running, and come out of this victorious. And you will. You will. We are surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses. So let us lay aside. This is our turn now. Every weight and every sin which clings so closely. Let us run our race with endurance, the race that's set before us, looking unto Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We all have that temptation. We all have the same temptation to go back to the tabernacle and just dwell in the tabernacle and come under its wings and abide there forever and withdraw from the world and go into a monastery and spend our time in prayer and so on and so forth. I became a Christian 25 years ago now. I realized 25 years. How many? I don't know if you think for long how long you've been a Christian. But I've basically been running various speeds for 25 years. And I've got a funny feeling longevity doesn't exactly run in my family. So conservative estimate, another 30 if I do all right. That means I'm not even halfway yet. That means I haven't kind of turned the bend yet where I'm going to get a clear view of Jesus. There's people here who've been running a lot longer than me. And there's some of you who've got a lot longer to run because you're going to live to 110 than I probably do. Okay? This is not a sprint. This isn't a sprint. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. Just keep running. Just keep going. Don't give up. And when you're tired and when you're flagging, just look over your shoulder and look at Jesus there. He has the crown of life to give you when you cross that line. And you will. We're going to take communion. We're going to take communion. It gives us an opportunity, doesn't it, to look at Jesus. We can't spend all the time thinking about Jesus. But that's partly why we come to church, isn't it? So we can refresh ourselves. That's partly why we read our Bibles when we get opportunities to do so, to refresh ourselves. That's why we pray, to refresh ourselves. That's why we come and take communion, to receive fresh grace for the race. It's not an end, it's a means to keep us going, to keep imparting to us what we need so that we can run the first. We don't dwell in the past, do we? We draw on the past so we can run forward into the future. The verse, Phil's going to lead us in communion, but I just want to just pick on that last verse, on that verse which says, whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, do it in remembrance of me. That whole thing of remembering. Remembering is not just about looking back at what Jesus did sometime a long time ago for you, though you must think about that because it is wonderful. I want you to remember as well that he lives, that he's here in the present with us. He's not just consigned to the past. Remember Jesus. He's alive. You may not have your eyes focused on, you may not see him physically right now, but the time will come when you'll turn the corner. Every single one of us will turn the corner at one point. We'll cross the line and we will see him. He hasn't disappeared. He hasn't gone anywhere. He's in heaven and we will see him. So when we're taking communion, do this in remembrance of him. I want you to remember the living Jesus who is with you now and loves you now. And may that be a source of blessing and encouragement and strength for you for Monday morning.